This is the Tom Hartman Program.
My friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Aretha Davis died. Aretha Franklin died this morning at around 9 o'clock Eastern time, 9:30, I guess. And she was part of my life. I mean, I grew up as a teenager listening to Aretha Franklin. And, you know, and growing up in Michigan, I mean, the Motown sound and all that kind of stuff, wow. She died of pancreatic cancer, which is tragic and unfortunate. Nate was telling me how she actually offered to pay the bail for Angela Davis after she got busted by the FBI. So, anyhow, at the top of the news. But for our topics for the day and what we're going to get into today on the program, there's a pile of news, a lot of things happening, of course. The Accountable Capitalism Act, though I want to get into this in just a moment, this is something that Elizabeth Warren is proposing, and I think it's really solid. It's a great beginning, and I want to, you know, get into some serious and consequential detail about it. In an hour, Omarosa says that she's going to release a blockbuster new tape. And so, you know, over at the White House, they're putting mattresses up against the windows. And why is Turkey affecting the economic health of the planet? And I'm talking about the country, not the chicken, not the bird. And what does this say about capitalism? We're going to ask that question of Professor Richard Wolff in the next hour. So, you know, a lot coming up today. It's going to be a fascinating day. But let's start with the Elizabeth. Oh, and plus, it's anything goes summer. You know, if there's anything that you want to talk about, give us a shout. The number is 202-808-9925. And, you know, we can get into it. So the Elizabeth Warren is pointing out that there were a number of changes made in our system of corporate governance back in the 1980s. These were all changes made during the Reagan administration. And, I mean, it's really amazing to think about it. I remember the 80s, and I remember many of us protesting what the Reagan administration was doing, but, you know, there wasn't much of an audience for those protests. They, you know, they were like, well, yeah, you know, so what? And, you know, I think it's a really big deal that we keep in mind how consequentially Ronald Reagan changed America. Everything from taxing Social Security, you know, cutting Social Security benefits that way, stopping the enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act, kicking off 30 years, going on 40 years now of massive consolidation of small companies being wiped out, medium companies slamming together into giant companies, and now we have literally half as many companies that are publicly traded, like on the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ, literally half as many companies representing, you know, more than twice as much wealth. So we have just this massive growth of giant corporations that are unimpeachable, unassailable, and have tremendous political power. They're spending billions with a B, lobbying and supporting candidates around the country. It's mind-boggling what has happened. And then so one of the biggest things that they did that was so wrong is that Reagan did, was he broke the connection between companies and their employees, the connection between companies and their communities, and the connection between companies and their customers. And frankly, I think you could also make the argument that he broke the connection between companies and the institution of the business itself, that CEOs no longer cared that, hey, you know, Sunbeam is a great company. No, now it's, hey, is this a brand that we could merge with another company and I could get a big bonus for making that merger happen? That kind of thing. And the main way that they broke that connection between the people running our companies and all of the various constituencies that they historically had prior to the Reagan administration was by changing our tax law to make it possible for companies to compensate their stockholders in a major way. I mean, they were doing this before this, but they were only doing it in a fairly minor way because there were tax consequences to doing it. It cost companies money to give shares in the company to their employees. Reagan changed that to where it actually made companies money. It was a deductible expense. It increased their profits to give shares to their employees. Now, you know, they don't give shares to their average working people, but they do give shares in lieu of compensation to their senior most executives and their CEOs. And so the consequence of that is, you know, for 30 years now, CEOs have been paid mostly in stock. And so what do? They try to do everything they can to jack up stock prices. So Trump passes a tax bill, you know, a corporate tax reform. This is part of the GOP tax scam. They called it tax reform. Really what it was cutting the top tax rate from 35% down to 22%. So, this is more than $1 trillion there that he just cut the taxes of American corporations. Now, if that had happened prior to the Reagan era, those companies would have put that money into research and development, developing new products. They would have put it into marketing and advertising, you know, increasing their sales. They would have put it into new sales forces. They would have put it into factories to build more products. They would have put it into wages for their workers. They might have put some of it into their communities, you know, endowing hospitals and libraries and things because they want the goodwill of the community. Or even, you know, something infrastructure-wise, helping assist with putting together, you know, local broadband systems and things. But they didn't do any of that this time. Instead, what they did, because all the executives, all the senior executives in the companies now are being paid with stock, what they did was they bought back, they had the company buy back some of its own shares out of the stock market and retire them. Now, what does that do? It reduces the number of shares in circulation. Well, the value of the company stays the same. You got a $1 billion company, whether it's got 1 million shares in circulation or 500,000 shares in circulation. So if you cut the number of shares in half, what happens to the price of the stock? It doubles. Doesn't mean the company sold even one extra item. Doesn't mean that they invented one new product. Doesn't mean they did a damn thing. In fact, they might have done less than all of that, but by cutting the number of shares in the marketplace, it increases the price of the individual stocks. And if you're being paid with stock, and last year you got paid with 1,000 shares of stock that were worth $100, and this year those shares are worth $200, you just made $100,000 profit. And it's because it's long-term capital gains, it's not even taxed at the highest personal income rate. It's taxed at the top 15% capital gains rate. So the executives are not only making off like bandits by screwing the community, the customers, the employees, and the company itself. They're not only making off like bandits, but they're doing so in an environment where they're paying half the taxes that you and I pay. This is totally screwed up. Right, brought to you by Ronald Reagan and idiots like, you know, the Forbes and Moore and all these guys who are, you know, these supply-siders. You know, two guys I've debated on this program in the past. So Elizabeth Warren comes along and she says, okay, we've got to change this. And I'm all in favor of this. She said we need to require corporations that bring in over $1 billion in annual revenue to obtain a federal charter. Now, right now, if you create a corporation, you know, unless it is a hybrid corporation that has some federal government involvement, like the Corporation for Public Broadcasting or Amtrak, and those are anomalies. But right now, the only agencies that issue corporate charters are states. So you incorporate in the states. Well, she's saying that any corporation that does more than $1 billion in business needs to also incorporate at the federal level. And that $1 billion in business, by the way, that's over 3,500 companies in the United States, would then have to have a federal charter. Now, why do you want them to have a federal charter? So you've got national standards for their behavior. And that charter would require that the executives of that corporation consider the interests of all the corporate stakeholders, the workers, the customers, the communities. Now, right now, they don't have to care about the workers. And so, you know, CEOs routinely go out of their way to screw their workers. They don't have to care about the customers. So, hey, let's import cheap junk from China rather than making something really good here in the United States. And they don't have to consider the needs of their community. Thus, again, you know, saying to hell with our communities, to hell with the United States. Number one. Number two, give workers the power to elect at least 40% of corporate board members. Right now in Germany, if the company has over 1,000 employees, which is, you know, kind of the same category, billion-dollar companies, right now in Germany, such companies have to have 50% of their board made up of employees who are appointed by the unions. Now, this would give workers the power to elect 40%. This is not anywhere near as strong as Germany's, but it's a big step forward from where we're at right now. And they would ban corporations from making political expenditures without the approval of 75% of its directors and shareholders. So you'd have to have both the shareholder meeting, or at least a mail-in ballot, plus 75% of the board of directors. And the federal government would then have the power to pull their charters, their ability to operate a corporation, anytime they wanted, if these companies didn't behave appropriately. So, of course, CNBC brings out a guy from the Cato Institute, you know, that used to be the Charles Koch Foundation, Koch founded the economic policy studies think tank, which is part of the Cato Institute. They bring out this guy, Jeffrey Miron, a shill for the billionaires, and he says, this is going to be really dangerous, he says, only honest and law-abiding companies will comply, meaning as those companies will bear the brunt of the regulatory burden. Right, this is like saying, only the people who comply with the law are bearing the burden of the law. You know, I don't shoplift, so I have to deal with the burden of anti-shoplifting laws. I don't rob banks, so I have to deal with the burden of anti-bank robbery laws. It's terrible. It's overwhelming. Well, anyhow, this is Elizabeth Warren's plan, and I think it's spectacular. And I encourage you to learn more about it and let people know about it. And, you know, we need to do something to fix corporate America right now. Corporate America is committed to ripping us off. I want to tell you about that and Mick Mulvaney after we come back from the break. But this is a great step forward. And I think it is also positioning Elizabeth Warren really well for a presidential run. It's 18 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more of the news of the day and your calls. Anything goes summer here on the Tom Hartman Program. And welcome back. Bob in Eureka, California. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering about the tariffs that Trump has put on, you know, everything. And who's profiting from that? What's the scam? Who's making the big money? Because there's lots of money being poured out somewhere.
Yeah, that's a great question, Bob. And I would love to see somebody dig into it. I don't know the answer right off the top of my head. What I do know is that tariffs, I mean, if you look at the history of tariffs, tariffs were first put into place back in the 1400s. Late 1300s, early 1400s, the 14th and 15th centuries, by the what were referred to then as the Low Countries, Holland principally, and parts of Belgium, and the Dutch did this and said, you know, if you want to bring goods into Holland, you have to pay a tax, but if you want to buy goods from Holland, no tax at all. In fact, we might even subsidize them, and that turned Holland into the first real worldwide, at least Europe-wide. Empire. I mean, you know, the Dutch trading companies of the 14th and 15th centuries were famous. And then
the tulips?
Well, no, this has nothing to do with the tulips. The tulips were came about. They came about much later. I believe it was in the 1600s, the Seven Seas scandal, the Seven Seas scandal, or whatever it was. You know, the Dutch tulip scandal. But there was a big company that they built that collapsed. But the only reason that was possible was because Holland at that point in time was one of the most industrialized, one of the most wealthy countries in the world. So all kinds of average people had enough money to bid up the price of the tulips. Well, how did those people get their money? Tariffs. The Dutch government built, using tariffs, built themselves into a powerful trading empire. Then in the 14 or 1500s, and I'd have to go back and look at the year, 1527 sticks in my head, but it may be wrong, King Henry VII, the Tudor king, said that, hey, this is a great idea. And at that point in time, England was thatched huts and dirt roads. There were not even paved roads. London was a little tiny town, right? And, I mean, this was, you know, right in the middle of the Middle Ages. And Henry VII said, let's do the same thing the Dutch did. And so he put tariffs on, because the major export from England at that time was wool. And he put raw wool. And it was being spun in France, but not in England. He put tariffs on the export of wool and on the import of finished goods. And within three generations, England had become the world's largest industrial power and trading power. So it really worked. And Alexander Hamilton looked at that in 1791 when George Washington asked him to and said, we can do the same thing here. And he read his report on manufacturers, or my book, Rebooting the American Dream, which reprints his report on manufacturers. And you get it. You know, Hamilton did that for the United States. And we became, you know, the leading industrial power in the world. Then, you know, starting in the 90s, starting really in 92, we reversed all that and started aggressively doing away with tariffs. And the result of that is that all our jobs left. So, I agree with Trump's instinct to tariffs. I think it's an important thing. But B, your point, you know, there appears to be a lot of the exceptions to these tariffs. They're doling them out to foreign companies. They appear to be going to either countries that Donald Trump wants to do business with and likes, not for purposes of national interest or national security, but for Trump hotels and things, and companies that are somehow linked to the Trump crime family. And I haven't seen a definitive list of this, but I see anecdotal comments constantly flying by. Bob, thanks for the call. Welcome back. Okay, continuing with my rant about the Reagan policies were actually most of them put into law by Congress. But Trump is ignoring things actually put into law by Congress. For example, you know, back in the day, there was the Pentagon came to the lawmakers and said, you know, we've got a really serious problem. And the really serious problem is predatory loans. The Army Chief of Staff, former Army Chief of Staff, Raymond Odierno, he said, the Army has a lot of experience with predatory lenders and none of it is a good experience. This is back in 2014. As a result of this, the Military Lending Act was passed. And the Military Lending Act makes it basically a crime to prey on soldiers. You can't target soldiers with crappy financial products. You can't give them documentation that is filled with fine print they don't understand and can't read. You can't jack up interest rates on them without warning. I mean, basically, that's what the Military Lending Act does. But the subprime industry, shall we say, the parasites of the payday lending industry are ultra, super targeting military bases. I mean, you know, as early as 2005, researchers found, this is from Carl Frisch's group, alliedprogress.org, as early as 2005, researchers found that payday lenders were disproportionately clustered in proximity to large military populations. The study also found that in states with high military populations, more than 60% of the 20 highest payday lending zip codes were associated with military installations. Now, military installations are not 60% of the American land mass, but they're 60% of where you find payday lenders. That should tell you something. A 2006 DOD study, Department of Defense study, found that predatory loans are, quote, prevalent and targeting military personnel with payday loans, car title loans, tax refund anticipation loans, and unsecured loans. Now, setting aside the fact that probably less of our money should be going to our defense contractors and more to our actual service members, they wouldn't need payday loans. Yeah, that's kind of a separate argument. But the Department of Defense came to Congress and said, we want unambiguous price disclosures, right? No BS price disclosures of financial products, number one. Number two, federal caps against usurious rates, federal caps on interest. The ability to, verification that a person actually can repay before you give them a loan, and preserving military's family's right to legal action. All four of those things are being undone right now by Mick Mulvaney, who's running the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, which is in charge of enforcing the Military Act. And six Republicans now on the Banking Committee are about to confirm Kathy Craninger as director of the CFPB. And, you know, Carl Frisch says, if these senators are serious about protecting our men and women in uniform from predatory lenders, they cannot support Craninger's confirmation to lead the CFPB. She will rubber stamp Mick Mulvaney's depraved decision to stop actively holding financial scammers that targets our service members and their families accountable. 49 senators have sent a letter to Mulvaney about this. I'll give you the list of Republican senators right after this, and then we'll pick up your calls.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
We'll be back in just a moment. It's coming up on 28 minutes past the hour. Oh, I got to tell you this insane story about Jason Kessler, the white nationalist who put together the thing in D.C. It's going to blow your mind. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Here are the senators, the Republican senators that you might want to contact and say, do not vote for the confirmation of Kathy Craninger as director of the CFPB. She wants to essentially take it apart. She doesn't want to enforce the law, particularly the Military Lending Act. And the senators who you should contact, this according to AlliedProgress.org, are Richard Shelby, Bob Corker, Pat Toomey, Dean Heller, Tim Scott, and Jerry Moran. They all voted for a 2013 NDAA conference report, which specifically said that the CFPB could enforce this law. And now they're on the edge of putting somebody in charge of the CFPB who doesn't want to enforce that law. And what kind of weird is that, right? So anyhow, picking up your phone calls here on Anything Goes Summer, Jason in Chicago. Hey, Jason, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm taking advantage of the Anything Goes Summer here to be off topic. There's a stat that you commonly throw out about the value on education based on the GI Bill.
Yeah.
Back in the day, I think it was every dollar that we invested would be $5 more that we would get back
into
the economy.
It was seven by the mid-1970s, I think. Yeah.
Yes, and while I completely agree that education is very valuable, I'm afraid that calculus no longer applies. Back in the 50s, you could get a dollar would be like 1/500th of a year's education. Now it's like 1/20,000th of it. So the cost of education has spiraled so much quicker than the rest of the economy. I'm afraid that we don't get quite that great a return anymore.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. It might be more like a 2-to-1 return. Even if it's a 1-to-1 return, it still justifies the cost of covering the cost of education. But the larger point, I think, is, and I get your math here, Jason, but I think the larger point is that if we were to provide education for all, the price of education would go down. You know, once it's viewed as a public good, as a public utility, as you know, and once there's, you know, good funding for it, right now the market is fairly limited. It's limited to people who can afford to pay for it or people who are willing to, and you know, throw their families into debt. I have so many friends who, you know, are in the 50s and 60s who are probably going to retire with 5 or 6 figures in debt because they put their kids through college. And my kids have so many friends who, you know, can't get married or buy a house until they're in their 40s. Because they're paying off student loans. That's the other side of the equation that is ignored in your math, Jason, which is the drag on the economy and the drag on culture and society by people not even being able to start their lives because they have student loan debt and people not being able to appropriately retire and thus spend money into the economy, which keeps the economy going, because they have student loan debt. We have extracted over $1 trillion from our economy in the form of student loan debt, something that literally did not exist 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point. I mean, graduating $80,000 in debt is not losing $80,000. You're probably losing $160,000 by the time you have it all paid off.
That's right, or more.
System.
Yeah, or more, depending on the interest rate, and depending on what percentage of people don't make it and default and end up, you know, with fines and penalties and the taxpayers then have to pick it up and they can't declare bankruptcy and things. Even if it's not 7-to-1 anymore, even if it's not even 2-to-1 in terms of expense, it's still the right thing to do for our society.
I was reading
Jefferson last night, and I'm working on a book about the Supreme Court, and I was digging through his collected letters looking for his comments on the Supreme Court. And he was talking about how the correction, the solution for the problem of a dysfunctional government. He was saying, I don't think the Supreme Court should be the one that determines what's constitutional and what's not. It should be up to the executive branch to determine for the president. You know, for the president should determine for himself what's constitutional, what laws he thinks are constitutional and should sign, and what laws he thinks are unconstitutional and shouldn't sign. It should be up to Congress to determine whether the laws they're putting forward are constitutional, and their authority should stand. And he was challenged in this by one of his correspondents, one of the guys he was writing with, writing letters back and forth with, who said, well, what happens if the people make a bad decision? What happens if the people elect a bunch of a president or a bunch of elected officials who are acting in an unconstitutional way, and you don't have the power of the Supreme Court to rein them in, to say, no, this law is unconstitutional? And Jefferson's response was that we should tax every citizen 1 shilling a year and thus pay for a national public education system that included college. I mean, it's literally, this is Jefferson's letters. And this is from 1818, as I recall. It was after he left the White House. And it just was like, whoa, am I really reading this? Thomas Jefferson calling for national public education. Well, of course he was. He started the University of Virginia as a free school. So, his solution to the problems of dysfunctional democracy was more education. And, modern day Republicans have completely abandoned that. They've gone in the complete opposite direction and said, no, let's make it harder for people to get an education. Even an elementary school education, let's make it harder. And let's maintain this local property tax-based system for funding our public schools, because it makes, public schools in poor neighborhoods poor and crappy, and it locks in poverty. And making sure that public schools in high-end, affluent, top 5% areas are really, really nice, because that locks in the upper middle class. And finally, Jason, the point of the, and I'm not sure if you made this point or if it was an earlier caller, but the Mark Penn in his book Microtrends points out that the middle class is shrinking, and yes, some of that is because people are falling out of the middle class into the lower working class, into the working poor, but more people are falling out of the middle class into the upper middle class because of college education. So, we just don't pay anywhere near enough attention to this stuff. Jason, have you said what you wanted to say?
Yes, I did. Thank you so much, Doug.
Thanks a lot, Jason. Good talking with you.
Bye.
Jerry in Tolma, Wisconsin. Am I saying that right, Jerry?
Yes.
Hey, what's on your mind today?
Well, thank you for taking my call. It's been bothering me for quite a while with this secret clearance stuff. I'm retired military, a master sergeant, and I had a clearance, and I know what you have to go through to get one.
You're talking John Brennan's security clearance being pulled from him as revenge by Donald Trump?
Yes, exactly. And what really irritates me, and nobody says it, is Donald Trump himself could have never got a clearance himself.
You're right.
No way.
Cadet Bonespurs, yeah.
I think there should be a law that the president should have to pass a clearance. Because it's ridiculous. It gives secrets away in the Oval Office to the Russians,
Yeah. Well, this goes back to the...
Everything up.
Jerry, this goes back to the rant I was just laying out a minute ago about how, Jefferson was saying that if democracy fails, which it has clearly failed in this case, electing an unqualified boob to the presidency, if democracy fails, the solution isn't less democracy. The solution is more education and better education. And this is the whole issue of security clearances. I think most Americans don't really even understand what a security clearance is and what it does, and B, they don't understand why you would want people who formerly had security clearances, particularly at high levels of government, to maintain them. But the whole idea that people have elected a guy who is unqualified, the idea that Dick Cheney and George W. Bush could sell themselves as the first CEO presidents, and that's a really good thing, right? CEO presidents. This is like, if the American people were well educated, if we taught civics and history in our classes, in our schools. Particularly I get it that they do in the upper middle class schools, but they don't in much of America. I don't think that you would see this kind of problem. So
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Jerry. Good point. And I think that this is, and the other part of this, by the way, that I think is really worth pointing out, is Trump going after John Brennan, because John Brennan has said that he thinks that Trump actually did collude with the Russians and is. There is a there, right? That's basically Brennan's thing. Trump going after him is not just Donald Trump punishing somebody who said something he doesn't like. I mean, there's certainly a large element to this. But this is very much like in 1798 when John Adams got the Alien and Sedition Act passed, which gave him the power to shut down newspapers and imprison newspaper publishers, editors, and writers who said things he didn't like. And they didn't have to be genuinely or accurately seditious. All they had to do was offend the president. And Benjamin Franklin Bach, Ben Franklin's grandson, who published a newspaper in Massachusetts called the Aurora, Ben Franklin Bach in that newspaper published an editorial in which he called John Adams old, toothless, balding, and querulous. And John Adams, the day that he signed the legislation, it was not the day it became law. It actually went into effect the day after. But the day that he signed that legislation, he had Benjamin Franklin Bach arrested and thrown into a jail cell. And you know, finally Bach got out on a $4,000 bond and then got yellow fever and died. This is not a good thing, right? But John Adams wasn't just going after Benjamin Franklin Bach because he was offended by what Ben Franklin's grandson said, that he was toothless and balding and old. He was trying to tell every other newspaper publisher in America, if you talk like this, I'm going to get you too. And it didn't stop them at first. John Adams had to throw over 15 newspaper publishers in prison before newspapers broadly stopped running articles about what a terrible president John Adams was. And I see Donald Trump now simply repeating that cycle. He's doing the same thing. John Adams didn't use the phrase fake news, but he might as well have. He talked about, you know, the deceptive newspapers and they were seditious and they're anti-American. And I mean, you know, John Adams turned into a little dictator. Thomas Jefferson left town that day in 1789 when Adams signed that bill and never spoke to John Adams again in person. Never, and he was the vice president.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, it's not like what Trump is doing is unprecedented. He's repeating the John Adams presidency in some ways. But B, we had a cure for that. It was the Revolution of 1800, the election. And welcome back. Derek in Houston, Texas, listening to us on KPFA. Hey, Derek, what's on your mind today?
Can you hear me, Tom?
I do.
Okay, good. First, thanks for being on the show. Well, we get through. But anyway, I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
There was the Supreme Court, I think that's how it went, something they passed a law about unions, like outlawing unions or something of that nature. But if I'm correct, it could have been Congress or the Supreme Court. But if either or, if unions are, you know, in a downward spiral, are being banned, so to speak, losing power, their power, does that apply also to the Fraternal Order of Police Unions?
Yes and no. It's a great question. It's the Supreme Court that has been chopping away at unions, and the latest Harris v. Quinn, and there's been a few other decisions. Where basically they're saying that if a union does something to help you and you don't like the union, you don't have to pay dues, you don't have to contribute agency fees. In other words, you don't have to cover the costs of, you know, if the union is defending you in court, if the union is fighting for a better pay package, if the union is trying to get you a pension. You don't have to, the union helps you out, but you don't have to help the union out. And what that is doing, and they just did this with public employees, and they're fixing to do it with private employees. They can't do it until they get a ninth member on the court. But I guarantee you that they will. And if they get another right winger, which obviously they're going to get with Trump at the White House. And one of the reasons why all these guys are like, oh yeah, you know, it's, you know, let's, but in any case, so by doing this, they've diminished the power of the unions tremendously. The police unions, though, are a whole different animal. They have gotten, you know, in their union contracts with police departments around the country, they've gotten provisions that make it really, really hard for police departments to hold cops to account. And cops love that. And so, yeah, I mean, the police unions are arguably the strongest unions in the nation. And they're also one of the few unions that Republicans don't go after. When Scott Walker attacked public unions in Wisconsin, he went after the unions of the people who work in the state Medicare office. He went after the unions of the people who work in the state Medicaid office. He went after the unions of the people who work in the state unemployment office. He went after the unions of the people who work in the DMV. But he specifically excluded the police unions and the fire department unions. And so the police unions are not suffering these problems. And I don't know how many other Republican states have done the exact same thing Scott Walker did in Wisconsin. But I'm guessing it's probably most, if not all, of them. And so what he did basically by creating that carve-out for the police unions was, number one, kept it as a mandatory payment. All cops, even if they don't like their union, have to pay into their unions. Although the police structure in most places is so hierarchical and so authoritarian, I would guess if you didn't pay your union dues, you would get tremendous peer pressure from the people around you. But not even a need to worry about that, number one. And number two, the unions are, you know, in addition to the carve-out, the unions have, you know, this we've got your back for the cops. So they're not going away any day soon. Derek, great question. Thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. It is coming up on 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Alan in Chicago, listening to Chicago's Progressive Talk, says here you disagree with me, so you go to the front of the line. What's up?
I was just wondering, you mentioned the Republican paper back in 1795?
Yeah, the Aurora, 1798.
1798. How could that be?
I didn't use the word Republican, although Benjamin Franklin Bach would have. Republican back then was a word that meant essentially someone in favor of the nation being a republic being a country where the elected officials are elected by the people in a democratic fashion. Republic and democracy were words that were largely interchangeable until the mid-20th century, and when they got redefined by conservatives. But the Republicans back in that day, Thomas Jefferson, the original name of the Democratic Party was the Democratic Republican Party. And they dropped the word Republican in the 1820s. And then when the Whigs collapsed in the 1850s, the new party that came out of the collapse of the Whigs, you know, there has to be a party that defends the interests of very, very wealthy people. It was the Federalists during the time of John Adams. And John Adams was a Federalist. The Federalists were the party of the rich and powerful. The Democratic Republicans were the party of the working people. And like I said, they dropped the word Republican from their name. So did I answer your question, Alan, or was there another?
Something? Yeah. Thanks for your clarification. I just wondered because I figured Republican Party, as we know it today, was established in 1862. And I was just wondering.
Yeah, it was actually 1856 in Jackson, Michigan was where, and then there was a similar thing somewhere in Wisconsin or Minnesota that brought out the modern-day Republican Party. But yeah, it's a good point. And you read Jefferson, and he talks about our Republican values and our Republican nation. And Republicans love to quote that, little realizing that in doing, whenever Jefferson did that, he was trashing the Federalists. Well, the modern-day Republican Party is the continuation of the Federalist Party. So he was trashing what you would call Republicans today using that word Republican. Alan, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening to us on Chicago's Progressive Talk. Wayne, listening on KBCS in Seattle. Hey, Wayne, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, man, you are a breath of fresh air.
Thank you. What's up?
I love your show. I've been listening to the old gang on Air America, Daphne Miller and all the rest of them. But I just love you. I listen to you all the time. Anytime I get a chance, I tune you in. But no, the thing I wanted to say was the industrial age is killing the earth.
Yes.
Went back. If you go 400 years back before, I don't know how many years, 400, 500, I don't know what it is, but everything was organic. There was no artificial anything. It was all organic. And every step we take into the future is making nuclear bombs, and there's like over 1,000 industrial chemicals they've never tested for cancer.
It's 80,000.
Yeah.
80,000.
We're killing ourselves. By the smarter we get, we're killing ourselves.
Yeah. No, it's your point is really well taken. And by the way, it's also, I think, a function of population, but certainly a function of technology. The planet, from the time of, prior to the agricultural revolution, 10,000 years ago, there averaged probably between 25 and 100 million humans on Earth during the, 100,000 years prior to that, at any given time.
Right.
After the agricultural revolution, we went up to a worldwide population of around 250 million. That was at the time of Jesus. From there to the first billion took 2,000 years. We hit our first billion in 1800. Well, it took 1,800 years. Our first 1 billion people was in 1800. The next billion people took only 130 years, 1930. When Franklin Roosevelt was sworn into office, there were only 2 billion people on Earth. The third billion took only 30 years, 1960. When Jack Kennedy was sworn in, there were only 3 billion people on Earth. The fourth billion took, as I recall, 17 years, 1977. The fifth billion took 13 years, 1984. The sixth billion, down to 12 years in the 1990s, I think it was 91. And now we're pushing 7 billion. We're over 7 billion. And that is producing enormous pressure on...
It's not just the people. It's our technology is killing us.
No, but my point is demand for food has led to the use of technology to produce food in excess of what our food-bearing areas typically could provide.
It's not just food. It's cars. It's airplanes. It's everything. Plastics.
Yeah,
everything that we invent is killing us.
Yeah, we're digging all this stuff up from the earth, which is... By the way, Wayne, are you suggesting, is this a Luddite call to action that we should abandon technology?
I wish we could go back in time and just get back to, everybody, all they need is a house to live in, a bed to sleep in, and some food to eat. That's all
they need. But they died when cholera or yellow fever came around.
Yeah, but people lived back then. They figured out, your human body figured out, and plus there was guys that... shamans and stuff, they knew how to give you a certain herb or something to help you survive. It's like, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about, but if I've got pneumonia, I'd rather take an antibiotic than an herb.
But would you sacrifice the earth just so that you could live? I would.
Well, this is the big question, Wayne. Is it possible...
I don't care about an antibiotic.
Is it possible to maintain the integrity of the planet? And that argument has been largely lost in the last century, but is it possible to regain the integrity of the planet and maintain modern technology? And I think that the fact that we are, number one, becoming more ecologically aware as our global warming is melting our planet down, on the one hand, and on the other hand, that we're moving away from fossil fuels. I mean, this year the planet is generating more solar electricity and wind electricity, more green power, not just hydro, but just solar and wind. More solar and wind power than the amount of electricity that the entire United States consumes. So this is huge, and this is spreading around the world really rapidly. And I think as we get off a fossil fuel economy, the next step should be getting off an extraction economy. And I frankly think we can do it, Wayne. I'm a little more sanguine about this. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.